Welcome to ITAD Talk and part two in this series. Here is your host, Jeff Bittner.
I actually started work with you guys, I think it was almost 15 years ago. It was actually through the, I think it was called Global Investment. I think it was Ritter.
David Ritter.
Yeah. So I started to work with him, but about 15 years ago. And then you, Sims, ended up buying. In fact, that's the Tampa spot now, correct?
It is. You betcha. Yeah. David's, I've got to know him when I started, David was kind of leaving. So I got to spend a year with him, working with him. And I can't say more nice things about the guy. I really like that guy.
You know, I've heard that from others also. But since you're starting to talk about your contribution a little bit, and I really didn't give you a chance, do you want to give us a little bit of your background and kind of maybe some of your past experience and then what your the transition through your roles at Sims?
Yeah, sure. So I graduated from Berkeley in 1994. Kind of felt, I know I wanted to do two things. I wanted to travel and I wanted to do something that was, it wasn't called sustainable back then, it was environmental, but those are the two things I wanted to do. I wanted to see the world and I wanted to see if I could make a positive impact. And so I started, I fell into a position with a Canadian precious metal smelter. They were called Noranda at the time, and now they're called Glencore. But at the time they were Noranda,
right.
and just worked, you know, in this industry, just got to learn to love it and just worked my way up from a entry level salesperson to the global manager in charge of Asia, to working on our board of directors in Malaysia. So I worked in that industry for quite a bit. I worked for a competitor for a few years. And then Noranda was nice enough to ask me back. And again, it's back to this mantra of not burning any bridges, even though I worked for a different company. You know, the fact that they asked me back was great, right? Because again, you play nice and, you know, you play fair anyways. And so, went back to work with Noranda and then was recruited. Noranda separated off part of Sims. It started like a joint venture with Sims and the folks that left Noranda asked me to come aboard with them again. And so again, it goes back to the mantra of you know, making friends and doing what you say and being a reliable person. And so I came on with Sims about 10 years ago and again started as a director of the US and just, you know, wanted to really, the global is huge to what we do. And so I was fortunate enough to align all the commercial functions to support global, right? So there's not one service in Europe, there's not one service in the United States. And we found that only by having a centralized global team can we really, really do that. And so I was fortunate enough to take over all of global sales 3-4 years ago.
Wow, impressive. So then does that group work 24 hours since they're kind of working worldwide hours or?
Yeah, it sure does. And so it's a challenge, right? I mean, you wake up and you have emails from India and from Europe. And then and at the end of the day, you think you're done. And then you start getting the email from Singapore. So it can be tricky, but again, if you set boundaries and if you empower people, you just let them know, come to you with the hard stuff, right? You hire good people and the day-to-day stuff, you know, it can wait till tomorrow, right? You know, I trust you in this type of thing. If there's an emergency, call me anytime, but we put you in these positions to manage the store. So I've been pretty lucky. It hasn't been as complicated as I thought it could have been.
So does your role then is more like, kind of the organizing of the flow of business, or can you kind of tell us a little bit like what your day to day is like?
Yeah. So we, a couple of things. So, you know, there's just a tactical day to day with clients, you know, making sure that we're meeting the big clients, we're penetrating accounts, on a global scale and right to show them that we can help them in China and we can help them in Cleveland at the same time. Right. So some of it is just a normal, you know, a client acquisition, but there's a lot of it, a strategy, who to go after, what products to develop for them. Again, you know, we're trying to develop things before they even know they need it. And that's been a big part of my job. And then all the, division, we also manage all our subcontractors. So all around the world, we've got a network of subcontractors delivering that global service. And so again, we're in India, but we're not in Bangladesh. And so, part of my group is establishing that network. And so we do have a, you know, best in class company in Bangladesh as an example. So that's one part. And then finally, managing where all the stuff goes. So, you know, we're kind of a strange business to where we procure material from OEMs or from, big companies. And then we also sell to big companies, right? Because, you know, on the resale side, some folks want to buy the stuff that we're buying from the big multinationals. And so my group also handles the resale globally. So to make sure that, you know, the laptop that comes in, we find the best market. So if there's a buyer in China that will pay more than a buyer in Germany, let's sell it to the Chinese buyer. As an example, again, there's always, considerations and freight and restrictions. And we certainly want to be cognizant of that. But on a global level, we want to make sure that we sell material into the most efficient marketplace. Does that make sense?
So can you tell us a little bit about what it might look like when you onboard a global partner or a partner in a different country? How long might that process take, and what I imagine there's site visits, a lot of phone calls and Zoom and everything.
Yeah, it is. And we try to make it as streamlined as possible. But the first thing is, and we don't change over partners very often, so that's great. Again, we want to develop long-term relationships. But the first is typically I'll go out and meet the people just to make sure. I know it sounds weird and it's old school, but you just want to get a feel that these are people you can trust, right? And that have the same long-term
values.
View. Yep. Exactly. Exactly right. And so a lot of it will start over dinner or a cup of coffee and just making sure we're aligned. And then the more formal part comes into where we have a SHEC team, which is safety and health. They'll go in and do a full audit of, you know, security, make sure that there's fences in place and to make sure folks are organized. And so so that's a big part of it. That's the second part is the physical audit. And that can, you know, depending on scheduling, that can take, you know, a couple months to do. And then, you know, then there's a contract negotiations, but it's usually a relationship and then the physical audit. And then and that includes financials and all this kind of stuff. And then there'll be the actual legal agreement.
Okay, very good. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are interested in how they might do business with you. So I think that's helpful.
I'd love to. Absolutely.
I noticed that you led the outbound sales effort and introduced Discover.org to your workflows, hitting a sales record for year-over-year growth. How did your approach differ from the previous approaches that you reached those results?
Well, again, we wanted to have we wanted to have a virtual inventory to where, again, the material needs to get sold where obviously legally allowed, but where we can get the most value from it. And before it, you know, in the past, I'm sure it's true with any company, we were very siloed where the Germans sold into the German market and the folks in England sold into the English market. And I get it. You kind of go to what you know, and culturally you're the same and this type of thing. But it's bigger than that. We're a bigger company than that. The material, we have an obligation to our clients that we need to sell into the marketplace that's most efficient and that, you know, where you can get the most money. Again, approved and audited buyers, right? So we're not selling, for nefarious reasons. But again, if folks need this laptop in Romania, and there's an audited trail to sell them to Romania, let's do it, right?
Got it. Okay. And then what were some of the challenges or lessons from reorganizing global sales in the EU and the APAC and India into the single structure? And you touched on a little bit of that, but I'm not sure if you had more that you want to add to it.
Well, it's hard because you never want someone, especially when people are the kings of their own domains. You know, they take a lot of, there's a lot of really, really good behaviors, right? Ownership and this type of thing. But there's also a lot of bad behaviors, right? Where sometimes folks will do things that are good for their country or their region, but not necessarily good for the overall Sims. And so the biggest challenge is trying to tease out those great behaviors to keep people, to keep the ownership part, but also making sure folks know that they're part of a larger company. You know, if we sign a deal in Germany that the Germans make a lot of money, but it's not good for the client in the United States, then that's not what we want to do. And it seems obvious, but boy, when for years and years and years, your compensation and all your personal metrics are on a specific individual site, it can be challenging to change that to a global view, because part of the global view too is letting folks have to have things outside their control, right? Because you have to trust that the folks in the States are going to do the right thing. In the example of Germany, and again, I don't mean to pick a Germany, I just use an example, but the biggest challenge has been to try to keep the good behaviors from a global sales role, the the things I like and say, hey, but also you have to know that you're part of a bigger company and we have to do what's good for the whole, not just the individual. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the context of the Global Asset Return Program with Cisco. And I know one of the issues that a lot of the ITAD companies have, and I was just wondering what you think or what may become of it, but like a lot of the equipment, like the Meraki products get licensed and then they cannot be resold once they're licensed because it's like non-transferable, at least for like the ITAD companies. So I was wondering if you could add anything on that.
It's definitely a challenge, right? And we try to be upfront with our clients, say, listen, we want to take back as much as we can. And we certainly support Cisco. They've been very public about, you know, trying to take things back globally. So I love it. I support their efforts and the ownership that they take. But I think you have to go in with eyes wide open and say, hey, there's some things that if things are locked or if you can't get licenses and these type of things, it can, you know, you're basically buying a paperweight at that point, right? And so, again, you can get the commodity value, but not much more. So I think you just have to make sure that the customer understands, you know, the extent of what you can do at global. And Cisco's been great, you know, so.
Okay. And is there anything you'd like to tell other ITAD companies or anything that you'd like to bring to our attention within the industry?
I would just say, listen, I think we're on the right track. I think we've got I don't know that I can name a bad ITAD company. Everyone I meet, you know, they're great and people seem motivated. And I just say, listen, let's just keep the industry on a positive streak because, you know, whenever there's an incursion and someone does something that they shouldn't do, it taints all of us, right? And so we've got a responsibility. Again, I want to compete with these guys and gals and we'll get in the dirt and the mud and all that type of stuff. But let's just try to act in a way that we keep the industry on the positive, right? That, you know, years ago when I worked in the scrap business with Miranda, there was always a tinge of, you guys are a bunch of crooks. And I just don't want that to be in our business because it just hurts us all.
Right. And so I didn't get to ask you yet, like on a personal nature, what kinds of things do you do when you're not running this large company?
So I've got, I'm fortunate to have a wonderful wife and I've got three boys. And so I spend a lot of time with the boys. And two are in college now. So unfortunately I don't get to see as much of them as I'd like to, but I like to, you know, I like to run. My wife and I like to travel. I travel for work. So I try to stay out of trouble. Let's put it that way.
Great. Well, that sounds like a well-rounded way to handle and look at things and to keep that work and play balance going for you.
Well, thank you. Listen, I really appreciate the chance to talk. This has been great, and I look forward. I'm sure I'll see you at one of these conferences coming up, but thank you so much.
Okay, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
And don't forget, the best way to support ITAD content is to rate and like the show on iTunes, Google, Spotify, or anywhere you might listen.